Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. We are a day away from Thanksgiving 2018. I ask my listeners for financial assistance to keep me independent, to keep me on the air, and to keep a roof over my head. My website is www.rusjournal.org. And on there, there is a donation button that goes to my PayPal account. It's always been very difficult for me to ask for money. I never had problems before, but, well, most of you know the story. But given what's happening in American society, the arrests, everyone getting shut down, my employability in university is, of course, non-existent. That was probably the case anyway. And this is a time for all of our people to get together. With my limited funds, or non-existent funds, I still found a couple of dollars to give to Jacob Goodwin's legal defense fund. And of course, I still try to give as much money as I can to St. Jude's and Ronald McDonald House. It might be a couple of dollars, literally a couple of dollars. But this is what we have to do to assist one another, and I ask you for assistance. Now, with that in mind, I'm going to do something more professorial today. Actually, I do that every time. Really open my mouth. But this more explicitly so. Last Thursday, Sven Longshanks and I did a brief program on going over some of the terminology that I use as a part of my day-to-day life. Both in philosophy and history, mostly philosophical terminology. I began there saying that expertise in a field, to a great extent, can be reduced to mastering the technical vocabulary in a field. When I say technical, I mean words that are used only in that field and are defined specific to that field. And every field has one. Now, how do you put those words to make an argument is the second half of it. This is what expertise comes down to. To spot an amateur in this field, in all fields, you know, political science is probably more technical than anything else because of how complex it is and how many variables exist. And yet it attracts amateurs who think that, you know, watching CNN is about getting information and they can make an argument as a result of it. And of course, it's usually just emotion. And somehow I'm to take that as equal to mine. Well, it's not. And it gets me very angry when people who know very little, you know, think they, not only should they have an opinion, they have a right to an opinion. But in fact, that's absurd. No different than I would have a right to an opinion on how diabetes is to be treated. See, at least in diabetes, you have pure cause and effect. You have physical realities that are defined by simple cause and effect. Well, that's not the case when we talk about human beings. So one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about some of the more difficult words that philosophers and occasionally historians will use, and that in fact I find myself using, sometimes forgetting, first of all, that these words mean something different in philosophy than they do in normal speech. And second of all, that not everyone is trained in the vocabulary of this field. We only went through a handful last week. And I think it's necessary. Someone in the forums someplace, I never read these things, I don't read comments or anything, but someone had mentioned that it needs to be done. But I end up using words and concepts that people kind of think they know but really don't. And more people are certain that they don't know. And the biggest problem that this comes down to the fact that amateurs use these words And over time, their meaning gets distorted. They use them over and over again in an incorrect way. And so as the years go by, that incorrect way becomes the norm. It is a constant battle. And I'm willing to say that about 95, I've been doing this now 32 years, I'm going to say that about 95% of my debates come down to the definitions of words. So, and I'm doing this in no particular order. The word critique or criticism. You know what that means in conversational terms. That's not what it means in philosophical terms. Our critique comes from Immanuel Kant, and what it refers to is refusal to take for granted the fact that objects exist external to us. We can't prove that. That's what Kant calls dogmatism. We just assume it, but we can't prove it. A critique is a means by which you analyze the interior concepts that you have by which the external world is constructed. That's what a critique is. So the opposite of a critique would be dogma. That has to do with the external world. The word method is something that comes up again and again. I've said that the definition of a graduate program in the humanities or the social sciences, at least for a man, is the ability to make good arguments. And amateurs don't realize just how hard that is. That it takes a lifetime to fully master. A method is the way by which you go about building an argument, defining your variables, and either deducing information or inducing information. With that in mind, you have the two methods, the simple methods of the Enlightenment, but they existed always. Empiricism and rationalism. Empiricism is a simple notion that the only thing that we know are the reports of our senses and the concepts that we invent to categorize them. Rationalism is a deductive science that starts from axioms. Axioms are statements that we assume to be true. We assume them to be true because it's impossible that they're not true, like the law of non-contradiction, for example. Something can't be and not be in the same respect at the same time, or because evidence points to the fact that it's true. So induction is coming to conclusions based on the amount of data and the patterns that you find in sense data, where deduction is you find truths in an axiom that had not been noticed before. Now, of course, the whole methodological problem is how much data has to support your conclusion before you can make it. What is a critical mass? You know, one definition of a fallacy is when your major premise of an argument doesn't contain anything else. Now, whenever you make an argument, you make a major premise from which you deduce your point of view. Well, your point of view has to be contained in that major premise. But to what extent is that the case before it becomes false? And the chances of falling into fallacy are just overwhelming. The simple deduction is used all the time. A bachelor is an unmarried man. Socrates is a bachelor. Therefore, Socrates is an unmarried man. That's your classic, very simple form of deductive reasoning. Now, our axiom, or our major premise, is that a bachelor is an unmarried man. Now, no one denies that, because that's the definition of the term. Now, when you say that a particular case of that exists, that Socrates or I or someone like this is an unmarried man, that has to be contained in your major premise. It has to have an identity with it before you could say, oh, therefore, Socrates is in fact a bachelor. Now, the axiom comes from the fact that That's how we define the term bachelor. Now, so long as that definition remains uncontroversial, it's a perfectly fine definition. I'm sorry, perfect syllogism. The problem develops either in the major premise, where that axiom just isn't true, or at least is controversial. The minor premise, that it doesn't make any sense, it's not to be found within the major premise. You say, you know, bachelor is an unmarried man, tomatoes are worth 35 cents, Socrates is unmarried, is a bachelor. Well, the tomato comment, it doesn't even make sense. It just has nothing to do with the major premise. It's not to be found within it. It's not contained in it. Therefore, the conclusion is ridiculous. Or in inductive reasoning, or empiricism, where you're confronted with a huge amount of data, and the researcher, through some kind of theory, is supposed to find patterns that either confirm it or deny it. Now, we have all kinds of fancy research methods that I had to learn, whether I wanted to learn it or not, computer methods, statistical methods, that give you a certain score as to how much of the data actually fits in the theory you're trying to prove. Now, it sounds all very nice and mathematic, except that you still have to define your variables. You talk about social science, psychology, sociology, even politics, economics. It's so impressive to have all of these mathematical formulae. And until you realize that, first of all, the theory you're arguing is not mathematical. It's in the humanities, not the social sciences. That the variables that you're using, say variables like education or income or family structure or prison terms or anything like this, that they have to be defined and they can't overlap one another. And then, of course, you have to draw the conclusions from the number, from all the numbers that are coming in. None of that is mathematical. All of that is purely philosophical or historical. The social sciences are the fields of things like philosophy or history, because those are the two fields that everything else comes from. They're the two master fields. That social science tries to make those empirical. Not going to make arguments based on, you know, documents and quotations and things like this. We're going to make arguments purely scientifically. And by that, they mean the use of statistics. They've solved very few problems. In fact, I can't think of a single major problem that these methods have solved. Depending on how you define your variables, the nature of the program you put all this data in, how many data points you have, the size of your sample, all this stuff, you can come up with pretty much anything. And with the tremendous pressure in academics today to come up with the right answer, you know, there's empirical data in China saying how women simply aren't nearly as rational as men. But you couldn't do that in America. Therefore, it's not surprising that stuff is in China. Because there, it's acceptable. You would be hounded out of the academy if you did that here. So when we talk about method and argument, this is what we're talking about. And stating it like that is relatively simple, but then put that over a 20-page paper and a complicated topic, you see that fallacies are very, very easy to make. Another one is idealism. That has a vague meaning. Idealism is usually someone who is a dreamer. Ideals that could never be manifest in real life. This usually comes from cynicism and usually exhaustion. That's not what the word means. Idealism is a school of thought that says reality is mental. Reality is to be found in the mind. And the world around us is, to one extent or another, a creation or a projection of mind. Next time someone asks you to prove that God exists, ask them to prove that matter exists. Usually a moron will knock on the desk and say, "You see, it's here." You say, "No, you just have a mental representation. of yourself knocking on a desk. That doesn't prove anything. It only proves that you're perceiving it, not that it's actually there. And they usually will laugh and with a wave of the hand, dismiss you. Well, that's what academics do. You know, well, it's true. That's academic is a phrase of dismissal, and it usually means, I don't understand it. The word linear, we hear the word progress all the time. Progress by itself is utterly meaningless. It's like a fact. Facts, some notion that corresponds with reality, is meaningless. You have to stick it in a theory. You have to put it in some structure of reality before it's worthwhile. Progress is improvement. The difference between qualitative and quantitative, you make a qualitative judgment, you're referring to something that's moral, something good or bad, for example. A quantitative judgment is mathematical. The GDP went from $1 billion to $2 billion. That's a quantitative judgment. A qualitative judgment is that that's a good thing, that it increased that much. So linear progress, the word progress is a moral claim. It's a good thing. Progress isn't a value-neutral claim at all. Another one that comes up is this notion of civic nationalism. What people don't realize is that the accumulation of the literature, that is to say the academic writing, on nationalism would take 1,000 lifetimes to even begin to scratch the surface of. I mean, I have pored myself over those texts for years and years and years and years, and there is no chance of me getting to more than a few percentage points of it. So making comments about nationalism, you know, be very, very careful. Usually what we mean by this kind of modern idea of civic nationalism, when someone says nationalism derives from the French Revolution and the modernist attack, the Enlightenment attack on monarchy, you should laugh at them. You say to yourself, wait a minute, the French Revolution rejected all things like culture and the family and posited the rights of man as isolated individuals and their property. Where does the nation come in there? Well, it doesn't. And yet the nation, for them, really means the state. The nation is a qualitative concept. The state is a quantitative concept. Civic nationalism never leaves... Well, civic nationalism is a oxymoron. A nation can't be a state because states could be drawn... The borders could be drawn anywhere. A nation really doesn't have borders because a nation is people, you know, speaking the same language and having the same culture and religion. That has nothing to do with the state. Oftentimes, the state is at war with those boundaries. Generally speaking, what's meant by the civic state is just national borders and the bureaucracies, constitutions, ideologies, all of which are purely quantitative. There's no cultural connection among people in the borders of this so-called nation, so-called propositional nation. The problem with that is that, of course, the proposition has to come from somewhere. I can't count the number of debates I've had over this. A nation is an ethnic, it's not a racial matter, it's an ethnic matter. It has to be based on language and religion. Religion and culture are essentially one and the same. The so-called civic nation is just the state. It can take into itself as many groups as are drawn within its borders. This has been tormenting Africa and much of Asia for centuries, well, really for the last century, since at least in Latin America from the 1840s on. These boundaries don't correspond with nations. They've made artificial quantitative states. Materialism. When you hear that word, you think of somebody as a materialist, someone who believes that the great goal in life is to make money. Well, that's true in a conversational sense. Although materialist probably isn't the best word for it. As a philosophical term, a materialist is somebody who believes that the ultimate foundational reality is matter and cause and effect. That is it. There can be no spirit, there can be no ideals, there can be no moral norms, there certainly can't be free will. For you to claim that there is free will is to implicitly accept the idea of a spirit, a non-material reality that has power. If you're a materialist, you can't believe in free will by definition, because the very definition of matter is something that is purely subject to cause and effect, like balls on a pool table. Two different concepts of truth, correspondence and coherence. Correspondence is something along the lines of a fact. Something is true because I could point to something external to me that it corresponds to. I just saw a man murder another one. I go and tell somebody. I testify. They try to disprove it. Say, no, I'm sorry, I saw what I saw. It corresponds with everything else in the world. So he's guilty. Coherence is something different. I want to say that coherence is far more common than correspondence. Coherence, this theory of truth, is that something is true when it fits in with your already existing frame of events. It's picture thinking, in a sense. We all know people like this. They have a sense of themselves as being innocent and wonderful and brilliant. And if they do something that's the opposite of that, well, that wasn't really me. I would never do such a thing. They have this image of themselves. And so long as something can cohere with that image, with that sense of self, it's true. If it doesn't, it could never have happened. Those are the two major conceptions of truth. But correspondence is, in the sense we've already used, dogmatic. Coherence makes a lot of sense, but stated baldly like that, it's relativistic. It doesn't really have foundations. It shocks me how many people don't give a damn about the truth or falsehood of a proposition, whether it be in morals or politics. I thought that's what everyone wanted. It's very naive. Now, people believe in coherence. They want to be told what fits in with what they already believe, with what they already are. People don't become nationalists in the sense that we use the term, because it would mean that they would have to completely rewrite their lives. They couldn't have the same friends, probably couldn't have the same job. Everything would change. They couldn't trust anything anymore. It would be a total revolution in their lives. That's why they don't agree. You've debated people who, you've given every possible proof that 9/11, the official concept, is a total fraud. That's really easy to do now. You could give every proof in the world. You know, you could show them slides and give them everything you could possibly want. No denying what you're saying. And they still reject it. Why? Well, apart from personal pride, they don't want to believe they're wrong. Apart from that, they have to reject it because it would mean, if this is true, that everything they've been hearing about this is a lie and has been planned this way, then they could trust nothing that they have based their lives on in the past. It would mean pure chaos, at least for a time, in their lives. That's why they don't accept it. The word historicism. That word refers to the fact that there is a meaning, an underlying foundational purpose to history. The modern world is based on a purely historicist point of view. It's based on the fact that all of human history starts from the most primitive and then progresses to the most advanced, which is our present day. Often, they don't define what this advanced is. Usually, it refers to science and technology. That is kind of implicitly the foundation here. So, the historicist idea is that progress is based on the development of science and technology. The society that doesn't have smartphones is inferior to the society that does, for whatever, you know, device you're talking about. And it's implied that these people today, of course, are happier. You ask yourself, are people happier in the time of Christ, or are they happier now? Not the things that they have or don't have. And you'd have to be a raving psychotic to think that people are happier today. Mental illness is everywhere. It's overwhelming. Almost everyone we know shows symptoms of this. Part of the reason for that is that up until the modern era, people lived in classes. This is another faulty term, because in America, when you say a class, class rule, upper class, lower class, whatever, you're referring to money. Well, everything in America refers to money. But that's not what the word means. The word class is identical to function. The function of the aristocratic class was to rule. They had a right to rule because they didn't have to work 16 hours a day. They had leisure. Leisure didn't mean to do whatever you want. Leisure meant a lot of work. But work in the social sciences and the humanities. And to be able to absorb this stuff over long periods of time that the average guy in the mines or the fields couldn't possibly do if he wanted to. And most of them don't want to. In a very strong way, a real aristocrat is far more free than the guy in the field. He may not be as happy, but this is what class refers to. Every society in human history has had this, and of course it still exists today, but it just refers to having money. Money is the ultimate ground of everything. If you have it, you are considered by almost everybody to be successful. This is what the word successful means in America. Intelligent, desirable, the ideal man, based on money. You could find the money in a briefcase on the street. You could cure cancer. You could win the lottery. It doesn't matter. If you have it, there's something about you that is extraordinary. Money is a magical talisman that gives things, words, we use words like class, you know, classy behavior, intelligence, education, the very existence of money in your bank account. The historicism, the concept there, is that history is moving to something. You know, when Karl Marx was a very famous historicist, also a materialist, who believed that history was the reduction in the number of classes. The vehicle, the literal cause, the friction that forced history along was the battles among classes. In the ancient world, you had a whole bunch of classes. In the modern world, you have two. The fewer classes, the more sharp the distinction between the two, the greater the later revolution is going to be. The difference between logic and reason. There are people that I've discussed things with that don't know the difference between a fact and logic. Well, a fact isn't much of anything. It's just something that exists. In and of itself, it's utterly meaningless. Logic is the design within which that fact is placed. Logic refers to the laws of thought, like contradiction, as an axiom. Something can't be and not be at the same time. Something simple like that. Reason is something entirely different. It is the ground of justification. What are the things, what are the objects, the qualities that have to exist in order for something to be true? That's the job of reason. Logic is a tool that reason will use. Now, in the ancient world and in the Orthodox world, the Greek term nous, N-O-U-S, refers to that third part of the soul that in fact is higher than either logic or reason. Reason looks for the intellectual ground of truth. Logic can be used, I mean, logic could be the same as rationalization. A murderer can figure out the best way to kill someone and get away with it. That's logic. reason is far deeper than that. The nous is something entirely different. The nous dispenses with concepts altogether. Adam and Eve were in the garden. They were innocent. They were childlike. Young children don't have concepts. They just are. 4-year-old can't tell you why he loves his mother and father, but he just does, and there's no question about it. The fall of man is recapitulated in this horrible thing called puberty. When you read about what Adam and Eve go through after puberty, that's exactly what happens to a poor kid when he turns 13. The exception of a handful of people who actually sail through it. Nous is this, it's an intellectual apprehension. It is intuition. Now, the word intuition has a few different meanings. The philosophical meaning of intuition is the apprehension of the whole of anything. You focus your attention on a singular, on an object out there, a tree or a cat. Intuition is everything else. The fact that you focus your attention on an object, you realize that object can never exist by itself. You're artificially taking it out of existence. There's no such thing as a human man all by himself. Human man is part of chemistry and is part of economics and a part of spirituality. It's connected with everything and everybody. People like saying that. It sounds good, but, you know, in a very mechanical way, it happens to be true. The nous is that part of the soul that receives divine illumination. Truths that are not irrational, but they're above reason. Some writers claim the nous and the heart are one and the same. The word heart, you know, the Egyptians thought that the heart and the brain were one and the same. Or at least I should say, thought is in the center of the chest, not in the head. When we refer to heart, we're not talking about the organ. The heart is the center of something. When you take all of our faculties, sense, reason, logic, feeling, emotion, all our drives, likes and dislikes, put them all together, that's the heart of who we are. But the hesychastic movement had a tendency to equate the heart with nous. It's that connection between God and man that reason or logic can certainly comprehend, but can't apprehend. What does the word positivism mean? Positive. A positivist. It's closely connected with empiricism. It's connected with a guy named Karl Popper, among many, many others. It's based on several things. The notion that the methods of science, like the hard sciences, chemistry, biology, should be applied to all things. All aspects of morality, everything else. If it can't be quantitative, if it can't be put into a computer program, it isn't real. If it can't be part of a purely scientific quantitative equation, it doesn't exist. The other aspect of it is that because everything has to be based on a purely modern concept of scientific verification or experiment, truth is non-existent. Truth is what experiment and science happens to say at any given moment, with full knowledge that tomorrow someone may discover something else. There'll be holes in the present theory and it'll fall apart, and something new will take its place. So true is something you put in quotes. You know, it's like Charles Darwin. You have a book, you know, Origin of the Species, except that he doesn't believe in species. A species is something that really doesn't exist. It just happens to exist for now. It will change over time. One aspect will become another. A species is an accident at any given moment, which means that everything could be everything else. Everything is matter. And the principle of alchemy is that if there's this fundamental matter without qualities, then you could turn X into Y if you use the right scientific method. Positivists will say that if it can't be verified using present scientific techniques, then not only is it not true, but it doesn't exist. Part of my doctoral dissertation was on Michael Oakeshott's criticism of positivism. It's a very popular theory because it's very easy. And of course, it makes the scientific establishment absolute dictators over everything. I've heard people use the word communitarian in a negative way. Again, this is where you have amateurs, you know, wading into deep waters. A communitarian is not a communist. A community is not a collective. The concept of communitarianism rejects the egocentrism of the modern world. I'm not making a moral argument there, simply the idea that the individual is all that exists. The individual is the primary fundament of everything, which is utter nonsense. In fact, the community is. Groups of families are. You can't talk about an individual without talking about that which created the individual. The schools and families and churches and everything else. The individual didn't pop out of the ground fully formed. But modern theories and social life do start from that premise. They actually take it as an axiom. The individual and the person are two very different things. The individual is an isolated, quantitative object, the ego. By itself, of course, it doesn't exist. It can't. Because even in describing the ego, we have to use language we didn't invent. It comes from elsewhere. It comes from the community around us, from our education. Communitarianism says that because the person derives from the community has precedence over the person. And that's not only a logical fact, not only a scientific fact, a natural fact, but it's a moral fact as well. The notion that you can't get an ought from an is nonsense. First of all, that's not what David Hume said. And there's morality is based on natural life. Natural means normal. Liberals will demand that you know, you banish the word normal from your vocabulary. All kinds of sexuality are okay. Races are all the same. But then something goes wrong with their heart and they go to a cardiologist and the doctor says, oh no, your heart is normal, and they rejoice. Well, wait a minute. How come normal works there? Normal works for the heart, but not for the whole person? The distinction between person and individual is absolutely essential. An individual is a creation of the modern world. It's a phantom. It's just the ego. It is simply a word and nothing more. The very definition of mental illness is for you to believe that you're the only person in existence. It's a pure delusion. A person is not an ego. A person is the creation of social institutions. Personalism has nothing to do with egocentrism. Personalism is a very Christian doctrine that says that if you want to talk about individuals, in the true sense of the word, you're talking about persons, not egos. I mentioned the word cause more than once. The word cause, as in, you know, I caused something to happen, has been one of the most controversial in philosophical history. David Hume is famous, the high point of the Enlightenment, when he said that cause and effect are pure illusion. We can't determine if one thing causes another. So you're playing pool. The cue ball goes and hits another ball, and that ball hits another ball, and it goes into the pocket. Hume says that from a purely empirical point of view, you have seen nothing being caused. All you have empirical apprehension of is that those balls moved in a certain way. You did not see a cause. And he's right. You didn't. You didn't see a cause. You saw balls clashing and moving. You saw a series of mental states, and nothing more than that. You didn't see a cause. Because a cause assumes this transference of force in a very determinate way. But that's not an empirical matter. You don't see that. So already empiricism breaks down. Immanuel Kant comes from trying to deal with Hume's attack on the concept of cause. Our motivations, we talk about will. Free will is a belief that my mental states cause me to do something. Of course, everything happens with a cause, but not a material cause. Determinism, or the opposite of free will, says that we are materially determined. Only materialists can say this. Materialist has to say that we have no free will. The word free doesn't make any sense when you have an entire world that you assume is based on nothing but cause and effect. But free will isn't that what you do doesn't have a cause. It has a because. A mental state that you have. You know, you're free in the sense that you can reason, you go through options, connect that with your view of the world, what you think might happen, and then you make a decision, and that's what you do. Now, we know that's way too simple, but we certainly have a consciousness of doing that. Assuming there's no great moral issue involved, we do that all the time. But it's hard. We can only do that only on certain things. Most of what we do is pure habit. But if something important comes around, we lay out options and we pick one. The basis of picking one is another matter. One thing about psychology you have to give them is that they've totally destroyed the idea of a simple motivation. Our motives go deep into the subconscious. Why we're the way we are, why we make one choice over another, isn't necessarily obvious. You look back at your own personal history, you try to think of why I did a certain very important thing, and it's not obvious why. There are many reasons. Some are more profound than others, some are more practical than others. Some you might even be aware of. Many of our decisions are based on the subconscious, but by definition, we're not aware of that. Our upbringing, our hang-ups, so many mental illnesses derive from childhood. We're not aware of anything back then. Our structure of motivation is pretty much completely opaque. Most of us, if we were called to give a full accounting for a certain course of action, we couldn't do it. What we'll do is give a mythology. We'll give what we would love the world to think is the reason we did something. Well, I did it because it was the right thing to do. Well, you know, generally speaking, that's never the case. In fact, giving a full accounting as to why you do a full accounting would have to take from every discipline on the planet. And 90% of it, the person probably doesn't even, not even aware of. All these cultural things, all these things that they're not aware of. We're free to the extent that we master this subconscious. That stuff that we're not aware of, we become aware of. But all that means is that choices become much, much, much harder. Free will is something that we're not born with. A baby has no free will. Most people, in fact, have no free will at all. They are determined by their appetites. They're determined by social norms. They're determined by families, by their boss, by money, by women, most certainly, what women think of them, fashion, social sanction. And most people are happy with that. They'll tell you that they're free, but of course we know they're not. The concept of free will has been completely perverted to mean I do something because I want to. Well, that just begs the question. Why do you want to do it? If it's a drive, an instinct, a passion. And when I say passion, I don't mean enthusiasm. I mean a drive. You know, a lust or anger or envy or something like that. Things that we often don't have any control over. Part of reason's job is to control these drives. because we have no control over these drives without reason, if we make a choice based on anger, it's not free. Now that anger can be controlled, understood, dissected, we understand where it comes from, and then make a decision, that's another matter. When you make a decision based on a passion, it's by definition not free. It's pure instinctual cause and effect. No different than a rock. That's why reason and freedom are, in fact, the same thing when it comes to our decisions. You can't be free without being rational. You can't be rational without being free. If you're not free, there's no reason to be rational. So the word freedom should really be autonomy, independence. A free man is someone who can make a decision based on axioms of justice and principles that themselves can be defended. To be studied over time, to get advice from people, take a long time to make a decision, that once it's done, willing to accept the consequences and defend them if necessary, even when they're not very good. You can't care what people are going to think of you. You can't care what your boss thinks. You can't care that people aren't going to like you, that you're going to be unpopular, that you're going to lose your job. The minute that enters into the equation, you're no longer free. In the sense, you're no longer independent. If you make a decision with all those variables floating around your head, it's not a free decision. It's a forced decision. That being the case, how rare is free will? It is extremely rare. And I want to trepidatiously say that I'm one of the freest people I know. Because the way I live, doing this kind of stuff, research full time, being supported by my listeners and only my listeners, I do exactly what I want. I don't care what the regime says. I don't care what academics say. They call me everything anyway. Many of my listeners, they don't like me on certain issues. I don't care. Sometimes I don't like me on certain issues. That's insignificant to me. The minute it becomes significant, now we have a problem. And this freedom is really the only thing I have. My listeners make that possible, because unfortunately, you need to have a roof over your head. An academic in a university, they may have plenty of assistants, and they may have students doing their research, and may have six-figure salaries and tenure and everything else, but the last thing they are is free. Because if you take an academic out, and I've done this before, get a few shots into them, they will admit to you that it's just for the gig. It's a great job, and they're not going to do anything to destroy it. There are a handful of academics who I will not name, who after a couple of beers said, "Matt, we know you're right. We just can't talk like this. We envy you because you can." A free man is very rare, and life is very difficult, because you are going to be hated. Now, the word nihilism is another one of these things. Nihilism actually comes, of course, in Latin from nothing, but there's no one who believes in nothing. Because to claim that there is nothing in terms of, there's no moral norms, that's to believe in something. There can't be nothing because you exist, so that's ridiculous. So what's a nihilist? Well, Turgenev, Fathers and Sons, his famous novel, 19th century Russia. And for some reason, nihilism has its Russian origin. And spread to in Germany, it was really the other place. A nihilist is identical to a positivist. This is what Dostoevsky made a big deal about, what Turgenev made a big deal about. A nihilist in Fathers and Sons, as well as Dostoevsky's own work. Fathers and Sons, of course, is by Ivan Turgenev. A nihilist is someone who only believes in quantity and the scientific method. This is why in Fathers and Sons, Barazov and the nihilist characters in Russian literature are biologists. They believe only in science. The science often isn't applied to morality because that's not a scientific discipline. Therefore, it's not real. Isn't that convenient? you have pure precision in mathematics when it comes to the physical world, making everything from poison gas to nuclear weapons to smartphones. But how convenient is it? That in how those things are used, there's absolutely no guidance. Nothing to make you feel guilty. So nihilism is one of these words that's used often to refer to someone who just has lost belief in anything. But that there's no such person. There's a reason he doesn't believe in anything. That's actually believing in something. This kind of cynicism, rejection, that's certainly a position, just like anarchism is a theory of government. Atheism is a theology. Nihilism isn't the belief in nothing, because that doesn't make any sense. The fact that you walk somewhere, the fact that you move at all, is a belief in something. There's a purpose to your actions. No. Nihilism is a purely positivist and empiricist concept that says the scientific method is all that exists. Nihilism has to do with moral judgments. Symbolism is another one. It irritates me to no end when someone refers to something as symbolic as a way to dismiss it. Well, it's purely a symbolic gesture. Not only is that not what the word means, that's the opposite of what the word means. A symbol is in fact greater than the individual thing that it allegedly symbolizes. A symbol is an entryway to what Plato will call the forms or the archetypes. In Plato's metaphysics, to be very, very simple about it, the material world is always changing. It's, in fact, usually chaotic. That means you can't know anything about it. If something's always changing, you can't know it, because the patterns by which it changes are, in fact, unchanging. Theory of evolution and the forces that make evolution happen, in fact, don't change. They don't evolve. So then what are they? I've never heard that question properly answered before. A symbol is a gateway into a form. If you see, of course, obviously you see that the material world is something that you can't have knowledge of because it's always moving and always changing. Not to mention the fact we can't even prove that it exists. All we know is that we have mental states that we think, we assume, correspond with what's actually out there. And we don't know that. But there are principles, though. These principles, to be knowable at all, have to be immaterial. In other words, they have to be spiritual. A spiritual thing is an immaterial thing. If it's immaterial, that means it must last forever. If it's immaterial, then it doesn't have parts. It doesn't have qualities in the sense it can't be seen or touched or heard. We can actually know it because it doesn't change. In other words, we look at the material world, which is a flux of changes. We don't even know if our apprehensions of these changes are even real. But we do notice that there are patterns. These changes might not be random. When you start building that level of knowledge, you come to realize that understanding these changes takes you to a different level of existence. The principles that go along with matter are not, in fact, material. The natural laws that matter obeys exist separately from the material. That separation is the world of the forms. The ideals that actually, these aren't man-made concepts. They exist above and beyond reason and govern the world, cause and effect of everything else, and in fact contain the very laws of thought that exist whether or not we can prove that there's an outside world. The principle of contradiction is way beyond whether or not we could prove there's an outside world at all. That has no, it doesn't impinge on that whatsoever. So Descartes, René Descartes, even St. Augustine said, you know, I simply can't prove what's out there. How do I know that what my senses report to me is actually corresponding to what's out there? What's external to me? I have no proof of this. Well, what do I have proof of? Well, The only thing that he could come up with is that I exist. But because in order to get there, you have to think. You have to reason your way out of it. Therefore, my thought process proves that I exist, because something has to be thinking. Hence the famous, I think, therefore I exist. That can't be reduced any further. It is an absolutely refutable aspect of the world. St. Augustine actually had come to the exact same conclusion many, many centuries earlier. And Descartes knew this. But that, you take that as a fact, it's irrefutable in one form or another. That has nothing to do with whether or not the material world changes. This is the level of knowledge that exists in the rationalist universe. That exists, this is a spiritual world we're talking about now. Because we can do that, we now have free will. Because there's a spiritual entity above and beyond the material world that we have completely rejected. Because for that concept we just said to be true, it doesn't matter if there's a material world or not. Something can't both be and not be at the same time. Well, that is true whether or not there's a material world or not. This refers to the laws of mathematics. All of these things, the fact that Plato was a mathematician is not an accident. All of these things refer to a spiritual universe that is not connected, at least not obviously connected, with the material world, but it in fact governs the material world. This is the laws of thought that reason partakes. A symbol is a way that we can, in physical terms, give a glimpse into that world. A symbol is something, it's not a word, but it's a symbol that when you look at it, like I said, the double-headed eagle of the Byzantine Empire, it contains almost an infinite level of depth. It goes to the heart of what the nation is. It obviously isn't just a double-headed eagle. It's not just that. It's your first gateway into what this society is. This is why we call, in all the Russian prayer books, the creed is called the symbol of faith. When I first got my first prayer book from Jordanville, I said, what the heck does symbol mean? Well, in the sense that it's a summary. It compacts the entire gospel, and Old Testament, New Testament, all the scriptures, the writings of the saints, into a few words. It's in fact the essence of all of that. And an essence is always a material. What is a right? Now, the word right could be used in more than one sense. The great Hegelian, one of the greatest works of political theory ever written, The Philosophy of Right. The word right there doesn't mean human rights in the sense we use the term. The word right is something that's abused probably like no other word. In American life, like most other things, a right is nothing but a demand. I want something, so I turn it into a right. If I say it's a right, there can be no argument. It just is. A right is an entitlement. Now there's two ways to look at it. Either it's an entitlement that comes from the very fact that I'm human. Not that I'm a certain class or have a certain job, or a certain life. No, I'm a human being, and therefore I'm entitled to certain things. There are people out there who say that, oh, no one owes you anything. You have to make your own way. Well, wait a minute. No one owes you anything? Well, I'm not owed a fair trial. I'm not owed freedom of speech. I'm not owed promotion based on merit. I'm not owed anything? Really? Well, how could anybody function without these things? Human rights exist because people do owe them to you. They exist because this is what human nature is. This is what God has created. A state can't give. There's no such thing as a legal right, even though that's the dominant conception of right today. A right doesn't exist because the state says so. Needless to say that if you have this legal claim, it also creates a duty to make sure that that right is taken care of. Well, I'm at an hour, and I've only just begun to scratch the surface here. Words like, you know, dualism and analytic and occasionalism. But I think what I've given you is a thumbnail sketch of the basic conceptual vocabulary that I take for granted. It's just the beginning. And what I gave you was very simplified. What I also gave you is the kind of traditionalist pre-modern conception of these ideas. So many of these have been perverted over time that serve the interests of the powerful to do so. What's happening in American debate is that word definitions are changing so often, are being deliberately manipulated, that sometimes we're not really speaking the same language as other people. I just define the word right, but often that's not really how it's being used. It really refers to any demand. I don't feel like making an argument for it. If I have a right, well, it just is. You don't have to argue for a right. It's part of human nature, right? So if I demand it, and I claim it's right, there is no argument. You just have to give it to me. No, of course, fact is that you have to believe in the spiritual world and the free will for there to be rights of any kind. The perversions of words are one of the main roots of our problems. Words like, you know, discrimination or, you know, equality. Words like racism and anti-Semitism, they have no definition on purpose. They're not designed to create any kind of truth. They're designed to create chaos and to keep you off balance. The deeper you understand the nature of the vocabulary that's constructed the civilization that you're a part of, the better armed you're going to be to deal with our oppressors, our persecutors, and that the hordes of amateurs who are just obsessed with having you wonder at how brilliant they are. I guess it's a lot better than doing all the work that goes into actual brilliance, because brilliance requires mountains of work and a lot of suffering. It doesn't just happen. Anyway, thank you, my friends, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.